You're listening to Psych Talk.
This is Psych Talk. I'm Jose Dras Lopez. In this interview, we're going to get a first-person account of Asperger's syndrome, a type of autism spectrum disorder. Along the way, we'll also talk some politics, and I'll jump in a couple times. I'm speaking with Jason Cockrell. He's a software developer at IBM and a libertarian blogger. He's a good friend, so full disclosure, this is not so different from a chat we could have in a college dorm or high school dorm. Do you want to say hi, Jason?
Hello.
I'd say how old you are, but I don't actually know your age.
I'm 19.
All right, so you're 19, you're at NC State, right?
That I am.
First, I asked Jason whether he thought of himself as falling on the autism spectrum.
Yeah, well, I do consider myself to be self-diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome, and I know that's controversial for a lot of people because people don't like self-diagnoses, and I can understand that sentiment, but I can also understand the sentiment of not liking medical diagnoses because, you know, that presumes that someone else is more competent to evaluate your own internal mental state than you are. So there's arguments on both sides of that, but I am self-diagnosed Asperger's.
Asperger's syndrome involves significant difficulties in social interaction alongside restricted and repetitive patterns of behavior and interests. For example, people with Asperger's find it difficult to get jokes or sarcasm. And although they tend to have trouble making small talk, they'll be very comfortable with particular topics that really interest them. Unlike classical autism, Asperger's has only minimal effects on language and cognitive development. So Asperger's is very much like a high-functioning form of autism. And because of that similarity, there's some talk of removing the Asperger label altogether. But that's a whole nother podcast, so let's get back to Jason.
You know, as far as what impact it has on my life, it's a fact of life. It's a fact of life like any other fact of life, and so you can't really separate what specific impact it has from anything else. It's a cognitive reality. It's something that, you know, affects my cognition, so it probably affects most of my beliefs and most of my emotions, some more so than others. It's pretty hard to narrow down. Certain things do stand out, though. I mean, I had a lot of conflicts with my parents growing up. Nothing utterly vicious or horrific, but we often did not see eye to eye, and I think that a lot of that can be attributed to some of my behavioral abnormalities that perhaps they didn't really understand how to deal with.
Now, everyone fights with their parents, so I'm going to push back on that a little bit. Tell us what sort of social interactions or social habits you have that make you think Asperger's would be a fitting label.
There are certain idiosyncrasies that I have had. For example, I remember very distinctly many, many times growing up, a specific point of contention between me and my parents was whether or not some remark that I had made was rude or out of place. And this happened many times. There are dozens of times I remember growing up where I had said something that I didn't think was in any way inappropriate, and that everyone around me felt very strongly was a totally inappropriate thing to say. And that, of course, is textbook autism spectrum disorder. And I've come a long way since then. I've certainly developed better social skills, and I am more considerate of other people's feelings. But even well into my early teen years, I was fairly well known for saying, you know, what was broadly considered totally inappropriate things, and genuinely believing that they were totally appropriate, with no real desire to hurt people. I would sometimes say things that I later found out were extremely hurtful. And that was such a reality for my life growing up that, you know, not to make excuses, but it was comforting to find out that there's a word for that.
Right.
You know.
Yeah. Give us an example, if you can mind some, even if it's sort of hypothetical or mashed together, of saying something rude after some family conflict or disagreement that didn't seem rude.
It would be anything from making comments about someone's hairstyle that were apparently very hurtful, all the way up to something that I had thought was a joke, and it became clear later that I really didn't understand the mechanics of the humor that was or wasn't there. You know, I definitely had some times growing up where somebody would make sort of a teasing remark, and then I would make a remark that I thought was teasing that you know, was evaluated as very harsh and very rude and very hurtful.
I see. Yeah, there's a fine line when you're teasing between somehow just poking at them enough and coming through as transparently judging them on something they care about.
Right. And, you know, one of the things that's common with little kids, it's typical for kids when they're just learning to speak to have essentially zero inhibitions about what to say. And almost every parent has to deal with at some point some kid saying, you know, you're ugly to some stranger or whatever. That's just something that little kids say from time to time. But there's an understanding that they stop saying it around four. And for me, you know, it was more like 12 when I finally started to realize how inappropriate some of that behavior was. And obviously, you will let a 3 or 4 year old get away with making some remarks that you won't let an 11 or 12 year old get away with making.
Right. It's interesting that you mention how children all start out from a similar place, because adults have some tendency to romanticize what children do. And I think one aspect of a child's innocence that can be appealing is telling it how it is, right? And yet, it's not necessarily appealing to seeing an adult. So I think for you, maybe you've encountered impacts in your friendships that reflect some people responding well to radical honesty and bluntness, and some people not responding well. Have you noticed that maybe there's certain people you draw on, certain people you repel as a result of your occasional bluntness?
Well, there's no question that certain people are more interested in honesty and certain people are more interested in convenient non-truths. And I do think that there is a role in the world for people who have very little social inhibition. I wonder, you know, what society would be like if we didn't have a few people every now and then to come in and tell us the cold, hard truth and not care about how we feel about it. But at the same time, you know, I don't want to make excuses for myself. Being respectful of other people's feelings is obviously important. And you're not going to make too many friends if you say everything that comes to mind all the time. You got to learn to moderate it a bit. But there are some things that are over-moderated. There are some circles of discussion where we spend too much time trying to protect each other's feelings and not enough time trying to look at the world for what it really is. So I think there's a role for people like me to come in and speak the cold, hard truth from time to time.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned earlier that we kind of think it's cute when kids say random off-the-cuff things, but it's not attractive for adults to say that stuff. But it is attractive if they're politicians, because in politics, 99.9% of the people are liars, and 99.9% of the time they're hiding things. So when someone does come along and just say whatever's on their mind, they usually get a very positive response.
Yeah. It's not to say it hasn't been tried before, because there's something about politics that pulls people toward lying, right? Do you think that's fair?
Absolutely. It's absolutely inherent. It's not a coincidence that most politicians are liars. It's inherent in the profession. See, politicians are sort of, from a psychological standpoint, in many ways, they're the opposite of autism spectrum disorder, because for them, appealing to other people is critical to their existence. They have to think about other people's feelings. They have to think about whether people are going to be happy or sad when they hear their message, because it's all about getting votes, and it's all about appealing to as wide of a demographic as possible. People who have autism spectrum disorders tend to be very focused, tend to compartmentalize things, be interested in specific things, and so they may not care about someone who is not interested in what they're interested in. But the politician has to care about everyone, because he has to be on everyone's side.
He has to be as likable as possible.
Right. He has to be on the side of business. He has to be on the side of labor. He has to be on the side of Christians. He has to be on the side of Muslims, atheists. He's got to be on everybody's side. And yeah, I mean, there's a powerful pull there that's inherent in the system that draws people who don't want to tell the cold, hard truth. They want to say foggy, loose, meaningless things that can be interpreted whichever way the listener wants to interpret them.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jason, so far we've been contrasting you having some sort of Asperger's with the rest of the world, which is not completely fair, because first of all, everyone varies in their cognitive traits, everyone varies in their brain setup, but also because there is a community of people who have Asperger's or some autism spectrum disorder. I'm curious if you've run into people who self-identify as autistic in some sense, and what you noticed about that interaction or what they're up to.
Yeah, I have run into both a number of people who are self-diagnosed Asperger's, and also I've had plenty of conversations with people who are medically diagnosed Asperger's patients, and generally I agree with the diagnosis insofar as, from my limited knowledge of, you know, the syndrome, I agree that they clearly exhibit the symptoms. Of course, they're not all exactly like me. You know, the community is obviously very diverse, and plenty of them don't share my political views, although I think most of them do tend to share the perspective that most politicians are liars, because I think about 95% of people would agree that most politicians are liars. They don't all share my political views. They don't, you know, all have exactly the same personality as me, but there are things that we have in common. Almost invariably, like you said, we're analytically minded. Most of the time, we're interested in things like math and science, although that may be just as much a product of the fact that I hang around in circles of people who are interested in math and science. And almost all of them do have stories of growing up, you know, making comments that were ill received. Not all of them have quite as many stories in that vein as I do, but it's fairly universal that sooner or later we get in a social situation, we felt that we were acting appropriately, and the people around us felt we were acting quite inappropriately.
Yeah. Well, I want to touch on your parents, and then we'll finally jump into the stuff you really love to talk about, like politics. We have to end on that.
Of course.
But we hit on this idea that you had conflicts with your parents, but you can't make excuses to blame everything on Asperger's. I want to look at the potential genetic basis that autistic spectrum disorders tend to have and probe a question about whether your parents have some similar symptoms or traits. We don't want to air their dirty laundry because, you know, they're not the ones here. But do you see yourself in them? Social aspects you have, do you see, think, oh, it's, I think it came from them in some biological way?
Well, I don't really know whether it's biological or not. I will say this much, hesitant to attempt to try and speak for my father in any way, but there are obvious and profound similarities in the way he and I reason about a lot of things in the world. First of all, we're both oriented strongly toward math and science. We tend to be interested in the same things other than just math and science as well. We share a lot of political views in common, and we share a lot of sort of feelings about social situations. My dad and I have both repeatedly expressed the sentiment that we don't enjoy crowds, we don't enjoy malls. We tend to get annoyed very easily if, for example, we're in a restaurant and it's too loud. We'll be among the first people to say, it's too loud in here, this is not working out. Other people in a group will be able to tolerate the noise, and we won't. So I do think there's similarity there. And I have often wondered, you know, how much of that is biological.
Most of what we know about the genetics of autism comes from twin studies. For example, a 2006 study at King's College London surveyed the parents of 3,400 twin pairs of 8-year-olds. The survey asked about autistic spectrum symptoms. The study then looked at how similar or different each twin pair was. It found that genetically identical, or monozygotic, twins tended to be more similar in their symptoms than fraternal or dizygotic twins. Using information about twin genetics, the study estimated that autistic-like traits are 80% inherited. Other studies with different samples and stricter definitions of autism have found genetic contributions lower than 80%, as low as 30%. But basically, we know that autism has an important genetic component with some environmental triggers as well. Which specific genes and triggers are involved is still very unclear. Now let's get back to Jason.
I think parenting style does play some role, at least in how you manage it. Whether you develop it, I mean, I don't know, probably not. But keep in mind that autism spectrum disorders are developmental disorders. Not everyone is born with them. Sometimes people are born and they sort of develop the condition later on. They may still have an underlying genetic cause, but nevertheless, it's a developmental phenomenon. And addressing it early makes a big difference. So getting treatment early. So clearly, you know, it matters whether the parents are active and involved and aware of what's going on, or if they ignore it, then there can be problems.
So. Right. Politics.
Politics.
So you say that you see yourself as potentially more of a truth sayer. That's one thing about your self-diagnosis that's just completely positive. It's not an impairment necessarily.
I think so, yeah. I think that not everything that you know should always be said in every situation, But I absolutely think that knowing the truth is something that's universally beneficial. I don't think there's such a thing as a good lie. I don't think that people are more empowered to act for their own fulfillment when they're ignorant. I think they're more empowered to act for their own fulfillment when they're knowledgeable of their situation and know how to proceed. So number one goal in politics, obviously, is to get people more informed about the truth of what's going on and the consequences of policies.
Hmm. Do you want your politicians to be able to lie maybe in cases of national security? You still want them to be really good liars when they need it, right?
No, I really don't. You know, national security means nothing if not the security of the American people. I don't believe that the nation is something that needs to be preserved in its own right. I believe that the people need to be preserved and their security needs to be preserved, but not the nation. And as far as the security of the people is concerned, I believe very strongly that the American people are sufficiently self-interested to rally in their own defense.
Let me give you an example where the lying might seem necessary. WikiLeaks releases a document with the names of a bunch of informants in Afghanistan who are helping the boots on the ground to root out insurgents. And some diplomat at the State Department says, that's completely fabricated, those aren't real names, something like that, or at least lies in an attempt to dismiss it, to protect the lives of those people on the list.
First of all, I'd like to point out that WikiLeaks has a strict internal policy that they do not release information on people who are currently actively serving in combat zones. But let's say hypothetically that they did.
Some people think they did.
Some people accuse them of doing that.
I mean, even the New York Times was pretty much insinuating that some sources were still vulnerable and could, you know, be raided in their houses.
Right. Because the New York Times has a long history of saying what the U.S. government wants it to. But I'll accept the premise for the sake of argumentation that they did release such information. You have to think about who would listen to the politician or the bureaucrat in the State Department who lies about this and who wouldn't. The interested parties, the malevolent parties who want to kill our men and women on the ground in the Middle East, will certainly not believe the State Department's lies because they have firsthand knowledge of the situation and they'll take advantage of that leaked cable and they'll use it. The people who will get the nationally televised broadcast of the bureaucrat telling the lie are the ordinary American people who are busy because they have two jobs and their kids are in sports and they don't have time to fact check that. And guess what? They're going to see it on CNN and they're going to see it on Fox News and they're going to believe it. And they're going to go on thinking that U.S. operations in the Middle East are happening one way when they're actually happening another way. And the people who are trying to kill our men and women are going to know the truth and we're not.
Yeah.
So it's really not, it's not better for the politicians to lie to us. It's better for us to be as informed as possible. And I believe that if you want a so-called democracy, which in its original meaning meant rule by the people, not rule by elected bureaucrats. In the original meaning of democracy, you had rule by the people. And if you want rule by the people, you want rule by the most informed people possible. The last thing you want is rule by deliberately uninformed people.
Well, Jason, we're going to wrap up just for the interest of time, but I'm sure some people are going to keep hearing what you have to say. So where can people find you online?
You can go to jasoncockrell.wordpress.com, and that is my blog. But another website that I would recommend even more strongly is Mises.org. That's Mises.org. And that's a place for just all kinds of information about telling the truth about politics, learning the truth about the economy, and the difference between violence in politics, deception in politics, and actually telling the truth and interacting peacefully with people.
Very cool. Well, thanks for joining me for this chat.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
We actually kept talking about politics. You can listen to that recording on our website, psychtalkradio.com.